This is edition number 1907 of The Mardler, recorded at Aylsham on Friday the 15th of March 2024. Hello, and a warm welcome to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk, recorded here at Aylsham. Turning first of all to the notice board, and we offer a very special welcome to two new listeners, Jeanette Raymer of North Walsham and Sue Adamek of Horstead. Good to have you with us, Jeanette and Sue. The only other item this week, the sun rises at around 6:10 and sets at about 6 p.m. Our week's news and views are from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 14th of March 2024. I am Simon Muster-Arthur, and the readers in the studio with me are
Jeannie Marden,
Beau Williams
and Ruth Harrison.
The magazine supplement, which includes an addition to NATO, a warning to dog owners, Our Lynn some years ago on British B&Bs, and of course that regular stroll down the garden path will follow a little later in the programme. Moving on, our first sections of news include
trial over death of scooter rider and bespoke dating agency launched,
fines rise for motorists' phone use and groper is convicted,
council lobbies for more funds and eight-year-old art prodigy revealed.
But we begin with campaigners' call for probe into thousands of deaths. Campaigners urging police to investigate the deaths of thousands of mental health patients have taken their calls to Westminster. Members of the Campaign to Save Mental Health Services in Norfolk and Suffolk have travelled to the capital to meet with Maria Caulfield, the government's Minister for Mental Health. They say police should probe into the deaths of more than 8,000 people who died while receiving mental health treatment in the region over a three-year period. The stark, unexpected deaths figure was revealed last year, following a review into the mortality data held by the Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust. Since this review, the campaign group has called for police to investigate the circumstances of these deaths, arguing some may have crossed the threshold of corporate manslaughter. The group says it has been gathering evidence for some of these cases, which was presented to Ms. Caulfield during a meeting last Tuesday. The campaign will also reiterate its calls for a public inquiry into mental health deaths in the region. A group spokesman said the situation had turned into the largest deaths crisis in the history of the NHS. It comes almost 2 years after the same group travelled to Parliament with calls for a public inquiry into the crisis. The calls were recently backed by Norfolk County Council, which wrote to the government highlighting their concerns. However, local NHS bosses sparked fury last month with their own letter warning an inquiry could put patient care at risk. In a joint statement, bosses from NSFT and the region's Integrated Care Board argued the time and energy an inquiry would take from leaders would inevitably compromise services. The mental health campaign last met with MPs in London in July 2022. But calls for an inquiry have intensified since then.
A Norwich motorist is to stand trial following the death of a scooter rider on the A11. Amber Potter, 22, was driving a Vauxhall Corsa when it was involved in a collision with a Lambretta scooter being ridden by a 64-year-old David Sinar at Rowdham. Mr. Sinar from North Walsham died following the crash between the A1075 at Thetford and the B1111 junction at Larling on the 15th of September 2021. Potter of Livingston Street in the city entered a not guilty plea to causing death by dangerous driving when she appeared at Norwich Crown Court. She did plead guilty to a count of causing death by careless driving, but this was not deemed acceptable by prosecutor Chris Ewell on behalf of the Crown. Judge Anthony Bate fixed a 2-day trial for April the 22nd, 2025. Potter, who was made the subject of an interim driving disqualification, was granted conditional bail. Members of Mr. Sinar's family had previously paid tribute to him in a statement released following his death. It said, "He touched the lives of so many people and leaves behind a loving wife, 16-year-old son, a 95-year-old mother, a brother and sister, who are all devastated by his passing." In his early career, Mr. Sinar worked as a vehicle inspector, a job which took him across the country. Prior to his death, Mr. Sinar had only recently semi-retired, so he could spend more time with his elderly mother and enjoy one of his many hobbies, riding his motorbikes.
Norfolk has seen a steep rise in the number of fines handed out to drivers for using their mobile phones at the wheel, following an update to the law, new figures show. Tougher rules have driven the substantial rise, but the more widespread use of dash cams has also been attributed with helping to catch and prosecute drivers caught using their mobiles. Norfolk Constabulary handed out 1,531 fixed penalty notices to people for driving while using a handheld device in 2022, Home Office figures show. This was up from just 241 the year before, although people's travel behaviour in 2021 was affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Nevertheless, 2022 levels remained above pre-pandemic 2019, when 1,144 FPNs were issued. This is likely due to a change in the law in March 2022. Previously, the law stated drivers were guilty of an offence when using the handheld device for interactive communication, but this was updated to incorporate any use. An offence carries a minimum £200 fine and 6 points on the driver's licence. The fine was paid in 896, or 59%, of the FPNs handed out in Norfolk, while none led to driving retraining. Court action was required in a further 635, 4 in 10 cases. Motoring campaigners said camera footage was being used to prosecute more drivers, but warned the best way to deter it was to increase the number and visibility of traffic officers on the roads. RAC road safety spokesman Rod Dennis said far too many drivers were still prepared to put lives at risk by engaging in this dangerous practice. Ultimately, we have to make using a handheld phone at the wheel being as socially unacceptable as drink driving.
A former employment lawyer has started her own dating agency in North Norfolk. Annabelle de Capelle Brooke, who lives near Thursford, has launched a bespoke and discreet matchmaking agency called Norfolk Cupid. She went through a really, really tough divorce 14 years ago when her children were just 6, 4 and 2. Since then, she's tried meeting people, but quickly realised modern dating sites do not align with the needs of professional people who are giving it another go later in life. When you're a professional person with good finances, a job, family and friends, and maybe a dog, you might hate the idea of having your pictures and information out there on a public forum, she said. With Norfolk Cupid, no personal information is made public, and everyone has access to a totally bespoke service. I will, within reason, do whatever people need, she said. I'll offer coaching before dates for those who are more nervous, help with planning outfits, and I'll be honest with people when I need to. I'm a combination of a big sister and a critical best friend. I support them as much as I can because you're playing with people's emotions in this industry. The Norfolk Cupid process begins with an initial interview for Mr. Capelle Brooke to learn all about the client and their wants and needs. The matchmaker then searches her database for suitable partners and arranges a first date for the pair. Afterwards, she takes on feedback from both parties to relay, avoiding the need for awkward conversations at the end of the night. Alongside starting the business, She is training for an accredited course with the Association of British Introduction Agencies. More information can be found on the Norfolk Cupid website and Instagram page.
A pub worker with previous convictions for sexual offences groped a teenage girl in a bar. Gary Douglas, 49, was working at the Globe Inn in Wells next the sea when he sexually assaulted the victim. Norwich Crown Court was told he had a pattern of offending linked to sexual impropriety against young people, with previous convictions for indecent assaults and making indecent images of children. The court heard that the victim, who cannot be identified for legal reasons, felt a grab at her bottom. Nicholas Bleaney, prosecuting, said she could feel his fingers as he grabbed her. The incident, which happened on June the 6th, 2022, was reported to police, with Douglas being interviewed in October 2022. He was also dismissed from his job. Douglas of Ashburton Close in Wells appeared for sentencing on Wednesday, having admitted sexual assault. The court was given extracts of a statement from the victim, who said she now feels unsafe and that the assault made her vulnerable and intimidated. Judge Anthony Bate imposed a 10-month prison sentence suspended for 15 months. He said the victim in this case had suffered significant psychological harm and was suffering from ongoing difficulties. Douglas was also banned from attending the Globe Inn pub for 15 months, given up to 40 days rehabilitation activity requirement. Nicola May, mitigating, said Douglas, who she accepted has an unattractive record, fully accepted what he had pleaded guilty to. She said he had a difficult start in life, where he was not able to read or write, went to a school for those with special educational needs, but was then brought up by loving adoptive parents. His sexual harm prevention order was increased by 5 years to 10 years. He was also put on the sex offenders register for 10 years.
It currently houses PE equipment, but thanks to new funding, it will soon host youngsters who love technology and maths and building racing cars. Oldman Peel High School in Wells is creating a resource centre to help find the next generation of scientists and engineers. Amanda Moffat, design and technology teacher and STEM coordinator at Oldman Peel High School, has said a new successful funding bid will transform a groundsman's hut into a new science, technology, engineering and mathematics centre. The additional funding will create an eco-friendly STEM resource centre, which includes installing solar panels to power the heating and lighting. This resource centre will provide much needed space and facilities to host our weekly STEM club, along with opportunities to invite additional groups of local primary students to work with our existing club STEM ambassadors to build another Green Power Goblin electric kit car, Mrs. Moffat said. The club has recently been awarded a gold award from the National STEM Learning Centre in recognition of all the work done to promote skills and careers at Oldman Peel. It was handed to them by Lord Leicester Thomas Cook. It follows the students successfully building, designing and racing two F24 Green Power electric kit cars at the Lotus Test Track. The club was so popular, bringing in 24 students, that it struggled to provide a space big enough for the children to work. Now the school will look to find a new storage solution for the PE gear so they can upgrade the groundsman's hut. The club is now looking for the engineers and designers of the next generation and is inviting potential new members to its first primary STEM club event. Mrs. Moffat thanked the support from Norfolk Community Foundation through the J.P. Blanche Fund and Dudgeon Community Funds, plus local sponsors like Wells Carnival, Hocum Estate and weekly mentorship from Silito Brothers Garage.
They are the fallen heroes of a war fought on a scale never before seen in human history. And now, an historic set of books listing the final resting place of every British and colonial serviceman who died during the First World War was due to go under the hammer in Norfolk yesterday. The Imperial War Graves Commission index up for auction is a set of 64 volumes and one of only two copies of the document in existence. It lists the location of the graves of British, Australian, Canadian and South African soldiers and sailors who lost their lives during the Great War, or the location of the memorial on which they are commemorated if they have no grave. The volumes list around 1 million names, along with their regimental or official number. They were originally owned by the Imperial War Museum, which sold them in 2016, following a programme to digitise the records. The only other copy is owned by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. Officially titled the Imperial War Graves Commission Index to Cemetery and Memorial Register of Those Who Fell in the Great War, Forces of the United Kingdom and the Colonies, the books were being sold by Keys Auctioneers Militaria and Medal Sale in Elsham yesterday. The records are expected to fetch up to £4,000. Oscar Crocker, Militaria expert at Keys Auctioneers, said, "This is a breathtaking and very rare historical document listing the resting place of every single soldier and sailor who gave their lives for their country during the First World War. It is sobering to see listed on every single page the names of 30 fallen servicemen and a total of around 1 million in total. Each of them had an individual story to tell, and each death was a tragedy for their family and loved ones."
A Norfolk council was to meet with government representatives this week to lobby for more funding as it faces nearly £1 million deficit in its finances. This week, officials from the Department of Levelling Up, Housing and Communities, DLUHC, were due to meet with North Norfolk District Council to discuss their financial woes, which expects to have a £986,000 black hole by the end of the month. It is hoped the authority can persuade the government that more help is needed to cope with the money difficulties, with members saying they have done everything they can. A report has revealed the wide range of increased costs faced by the authority, ranging from a £35,000 overspend on car parking machine repairs, more than £1 million spent on temporary accommodation, and £200,000 on agency staff. Other factors that have hit the council's finances include the cancellation of the Mammoth Marathon in May last year, £35,000. Energy costs that have gone over budget by £123,000, and emergency tree works costing £60,000. However, some of this overspend has been balanced by savings and increased income, but overall, rising costs have led to this growing deficit of £986,000. At a North Norfolk District Council meeting, Lucy Shires, portfolio holder for finance, said one of the biggest problems was the cost of temporary accommodation and that government housing subsidies have only covered half of the costs. Councillor Wendy Fredericks hoped that the meeting this week will allow them to show DLUHC the unique need of housing in North Norfolk, adding that the council had tried everything we can to cope with the financial problems. Tim Adams, leader of the council, said it was good that the authority's money problems were on the government's radar and that they will continue to work together to highlight the problems we are continually facing.
And here are one or two shorter items of news. A new film sheds light on the devastating impact of coastal erosion in a Norfolk village, featuring insight from both locals and experts. After the Tide has been directed by Joseph Harrington, an independent filmmaker based in Norfolk, and the producers are Evie Callaby and James Dan. It was filmed in Haysborough and features four main contributors: Bryony Nearop Reading, Melvin Chaley, and Nicola Bayliss, who lived there, and Sophie Day, who was a senior research associate at UEA. Mr. Harrington said, "After the Tide explores the pressing issue of coastal erosion and how the idyllic village of Haysborough is threatened by a new wave of government policy. Across the UK, coastal erosion has borne a constant threat and hundreds of villages have been lost over the centuries to the encroaching tide. However, with the threat of climate change, a dramatic rise in sea levels and hard defences failing, these communities are facing rapid rates of erosion, which threaten their way of life." He has now launched a fundraising campaign to bring the documentary film to a wider audience, which includes licensing archive and news broadcaster footage. Donate and watch the trailer at Indiegogo, and I'll spell that, indiegogo.com/projects/after-the-tide-feature-documentary. And plans to transform a former Coast Guard station site and boathouse into holiday lets have been approved. North Norfolk District Council has rubber-stamped the plans to restore and convert the redundant buildings in Wells into two holiday lets. The four properties, which date back to 1884 on 16 Bases Lane, consist of a larger detached two-storey house that accommodated the senior Coast Guard, two semi-detached properties which accommodated Coast Guard officers, and the Coast Guard station. The operational offices will form one of the lets, while the boathouse will form the other, with two bedrooms, one shower room, an open-plan kitchenette, and a dining and living area. The plans were first reported back in January, with the officer report published in March adding, "It is considered that the proposed development complies with the relevant development plan policies. Accordingly, approval is recommended subject to conditions." Until 2022, the site served as an active government agency Coast Guard rescue station and had a 138-year operational history. The houses were sold by the Coast Guard estate in the 1980s, with the sole remaining Coast Guard property relocating to the new police station in 2022.
The saga involving noisy heat pumps at a school continues as a council aims to solve the problem. Last week, Broadland Council met with Reefham High School to try and resolve the heating device issue. And following that meeting, the council says it will continue to work with the school to try and solve the problem and will engage with people living nearby this week. The installation of the heat pumps had upset neighbours who claim they cannot open their windows or use their gardens without being disturbed. Last month, the school was ordered to switch them off by the council, but people living close by forwarded an email from Christopher Watts, a planning officer at Broadland, which said, "The pumps are continuing to run, despite the council requesting that these are turned off." The email added the council arranged to urgently meet with the school last week to discuss this matter further, including alternative means of heating as suggested previously, and implications if this is not expedited. A council spokesman added, "Following the meeting, the council will continue to work with the school and will be engaging with residents this week." The school was contacted for comment. And a Norfolk railway line has scooped national recognition after being named one of UK's most scenic. Time Out magazine has released its list of the 11 most scenic train journeys, with North Norfolk's Poppy Line being named second. The 5.5-mile Heritage Line runs along the Sheringham coastline before turning inland through the countryside between Weyburn and Holt. Last week, the railway opened its bookings for this year with the introduction of comedy dining nights as well as sausage and mash trains. The Time Out article said, "We've said it before and we'll say it again. North Norfolk might just be the most underrated part of England. The entire coast is an absolute delight, filled with gorgeous seaside villages and a very real sense of charm. And the so-called Poppy Line is an adorable way to explore it. The steam trains have been running on the line since 1887, with a brief 11-year closure in 1964.
While many adults would struggle to draw much more than a stick figure, a talented 8-year-old is creating impressive artwork well beyond his years. William Hall from Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk has a residency at the Makers Gallery in Holt over the weekend of March 16th and 17th, 2024. The pop-up space is located in Chapel Yard in the North Norfolk town, and it will be open from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. on both days. He will be joined by fellow artist and co-owner of the Makers Gallery, John Frith, with work by both of them available to buy. Mr. Frith and his wife Katie opened the pop-up space in the summer of 2022 for artists and creatives to hire, and accommodation is also available above the shop. Mrs. Frith said, "William's mum, Emma, is one of my best friends, and he has a real creative mind and is so talented. It is very exciting at the age of 8 to have your own exhibition, and it is the start of a great future." And North Walsham has played host to a successful Taster Chess tournament. On February the 23rd, a 5-round Taster Chess tournament took place at North Walsham Community Centre. The event saw 66 participants of diverse ages. The event was organised by Norfolk County Chess Association, NCCA, in conjunction with North Walsham Library Chess Club, NWLCC. It was aimed at offering inexperienced players a taste of the competitive chess scene. The players received a chance to engage in friendly games with FM Martin Walker, the reigning Norfolk County Chess Champion, and were challenged to an array of chess puzzles. The main tournament winner in the open section was Ashley Robinson from North Walsham. Larissa Klepikowska from Lowestoft took the top prize in the under-18 category. Dan Joel Alwyn Christopher from Norwich Juniors won the under-13s, and George Potter, also from Norwich Juniors, saw success in the under-11s. The under-9 section concluded with a tie between Ronnie Chariot of Coleman School and Alexander Tichina from Norwich Juniors. Further details pertaining to other Norfolk chess clubs and face-to-face venues can be accessed via norfolkchess.org.
A former nurse has launched a new beauty salon in North Norfolk, and it's already been nominated for an award. Offering beauty and nail services in Blakeney, Coastal Beauty Blakeney was launched by Rebecca Barden, who used to work as a nurse at the Norfolk and Norwich University Hospital. After nearly 2 years of training to become a beautician and skincare specialist, Ms. Barden self-funded the launch of her small independent business by transforming her garden cabin into a beauty salon. Discovering a gap in the market between Holt and Wells, Ms. Barden decided to open her salon to make beauty services more accessible for local clients in Blakeney. "It went off the scales with people wanting treatments," she said. "All I want to do is look after people. I want to create a safe space for somebody to come and relax, because everybody loves a bit of tender love and care." Since opening in January, the business has been nominated as one of the best beauty salons in Norfolk in the Muddy Stiletto Awards 2024. In the future, Miss Barden hopes to expand her beauty salon by offering services at local businesses. And a North Norfolk floristry business has been rebranded and given a new home by a mother of two. Petals and Blooms, formerly in Staithe Street in Wells next the sea, closed its shop in February after owner Sarah Jefford decided to retire. Not wanting to let the family business go, daughter Amy Belton decided to take the helm, launching under the new name of The Flower Hut. With rent prices at the bricks and mortar store soaring, Mrs. Belton decided to make the move into her garage, creating a dedicated floristry workspace. She said, "I always knew I wanted to be a part of the family business, so after going through everything with my mum, I decided now is the time. My philosophy for flowers is that I'm a great believer in delivering happiness, but flowers can say so much in many different ways." Since opening on March 1st, the business has had a successful start with a fully booked Mother's Day, seeing Mrs. Belton single-handedly making over 60 arrangements and personally handing out 2,500 posters. She is also pushing to become more sustainable by using more eco-friendly packaging and cutting down plastic.
Recent wet weather has allowed an invasive species of plant to thrive well ahead of its usual growing season, experts have warned. Japanese knotweed is native to East Asia and was introduced to the UK in the 1800s, where it has since spread out of control. It can grow up to 4 inches a day and forms dense thickets which can kill native plant species, making it particularly harmful to the flora of the Norfolk Broads. And following one of the wettest Februarys on record and higher than average temperatures, the weed has seen a boom in reported sightings. Daniel Docking, a technical manager for the Property Care Association's Invasive Weed Control Group, said, "We can still expect a late season frost and dry weather in March and April, but Japanese knotweed has already started to establish itself. The plant's resilience will mean it is in a strong position to thrive, even as the temperatures drop again and other plants slow their growth. People in Norfolk are being urged to report any sightings of the plant to relevant authorities, which include the Norfolk Non-Native Species Initiative and the Broads Authority. The plant is identified by distinctive red stems and bamboo-like appearance. It can grow up to 8 feet tall and its roots can reach as wide as 28 feet. Mr. Docking added that if Japanese knotweed is found on private land, the landowner must take the necessary steps to prevent its further growth as defined by the law. Tackling its spread costs the UK nearly £250 million a year, according to invasive plant specialists EnviroNet, with an estimated 5% of homes affected across the UK.
Police arrested a man who left a suicide note at his wife's house and charged him with harassment days before he took his own life, an inquest has heard. Father of five, Sean Smith, was found dead in the Clive Village Hall car park on July the 2nd last year. He was 35. But an inquest into his death heard that 2 days earlier he had been charged with harassment after his wife had phoned police, fearing for his welfare after he left a suicide note outside her home. In a short statement read to Norfolk Coroner's Court, his partner of 16 years and wife of 9, Kaylee Holman-Smith, said, "Healthcare and police failed him on more than one occasion." Laura Hines, his sister, told the court, "He was let down so badly." The court heard Mr. Smith suffered with depression and anxiety while also battling post-traumatic stress disorder after being attacked as a teenager. In the months leading up to his death, he had been prescribed with antidepressants and was receiving cognitive behavioural therapy, but had been discharged from wellbeing services less than a month before he died. Meanwhile, the court also heard allegations that he had been bullied over his mental ill health while working at Booker Wholesalers in Holt. Although he had left the company and found a new job as a security guard by the time of his death. Area Coroner Yvonne Blake concluded his death was suicide, with the medical cause given as carbon monoxide poisoning. She said, "He did seek some help, but he did not carry on with it perhaps as long as he should have done." When his wife called the police, she had done so to get him help, and we have heard evidence that she shouted at officers when they charged him. He clearly felt he could not see any other way out.
A Norfolk council is to take action over the site of a former Victorian hotel that has been a blight on a seaside town for more than a decade. North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, is to issue a compulsory purchase order and buy the Shannox Hotel plot on Sheringham's Promenade, bringing a 14-year saga to an end. It is hoped the site, which has been left as rubble after the building was demolished in 2021, will be revitalised in the future, although there is a risk that the cash-strapped council will lose money in the transaction. Members agreed to the compulsory purchase, a legal tool that allows councils to acquire land or property, at a cabinet meeting this week. Liz Withington, Sheringham District Councillor, praised the decision and said it will be very much appreciated by the Sheringham community. It has been a difficult and long process, but it is a critical thing to do, she added. Shannox Hotel has been described as a blight on the Sheringham Conservation Area for several years. Council leader Tim Adams said the authority had explored every avenue and that issuing the CPO was a last resort. It is likely NNDC will seek to sell the site to recoup the cost of purchasing the plot, but officers have warned it is likely it will not be able to recover all of the money invested. Following the decision, a spokesman for Huddies has said NNDC's interest in Huddies property is a fig leaf for the council's long-standing desire to develop the adjacent Chequers car park. Huddies remains committed to its plans to redevelop its property. Threats and inaction. The 14-year saga between NNDC and the owners of the Shannox Hotel is one of false starts and promises that failed to come to fruition. It was once a grand hotel located in a prime spot in the seaside town and had been frequented by thousands of visitors for more than a century. It had become a derelict eyesore by 2010. Owners of the site, Huddies, faced the threat of court action in 2015 after the company had failed to maintain the building. But following this challenge, the developers applied to revamp the site and turn it into shops and flats, which was approved in 2017. However, years of inaction led NNDC to consider forcing a CPO in January 2020. This had the effect of encouraging Huddies to begin work on the development, which led to a wrecking ball being brought in to demolish the building in 2021. 4 months after the hotel was bulldozed, the site remained a barren wasteland of rubble. The promise of redevelopment later stalled, with the developers blaming rising costs and building material and labour shortages. This resulted in NNDC agreeing this week to take the final step and complete the CPO.
A ceremony is being held to mark the installation of the first of a series of information boards at a historic Norfolk battle site. The Battle of North Walsham was fought in June 1381, about a mile south of the town, on what was then Heath. It was part of the Peasants' Revolt, a major uprising across England. The revolt, also known as Wat Tyler's Rebellion or the Great Rising, began in Brentwood, Essex, in May and culminated in rebels entering London on June 13th. The uprising brought violence to the capital, with the rebels even entering the Tower of London. However, the revolt eventually ended with Tyler's death at Smithfield on June 15th. A number of the revolts took place in Norfolk, which led to the Battle of North Walsham. Now, a new information board will be put in place in the town on March 25th at 2:30 p.m. as part of a project jointly funded by the Battlefield Trust, the People of 1381 Project, and North Walsham Town Council. Bob Wright, the Mayor of North Walsham Town Council, will formally launch the board. North Walsham is proud of its rather rebellious past, so I'm really pleased to see this information board that recognises and celebrates the battle here in 1381, he said. Professor Adrian Bell, the principal investigator of The People of 1381, said, "We were delighted to work with our partners to bring a revised interpretation to this important battlefield site, and through our careful work with the archival sources, are able to highlight some of the life stories of rebels who fought here on this fateful day." David Austin, National Operations Director of the Battlefields Trust, added, "Although small, the battle mattered, and the people who fought there can be now better remembered. This will greatly help with that." And there are photographs of various folk in 14th century garb brandishing likely weaponry of the era, some representing their peasant status, a black-robed cleric complete with crucifix on a staff, and an attendant dame with a red hood, shawl, basket, and pottery jug, all looking particularly menacing, but rising to the occasion.
You are listening to edition number 1907 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday the 15th of March 2024. We have reports on an ignored local town, Haysborough fossils, plus the 50th anniversary of a coastal fish shop, amongst others. And of course, there's the magazine supplement all still to come. But before all of that, we have a letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News concerning a special thank you.
"I would like to thank Sheringham locals and people from surrounding areas for their amazing donations and support throughout my fundraising event for cancer research. This event took place on the 18th of February at the Tyneside Club, Sheringham, where there wasn't an empty seat in the house. The Tyneside staff were very helpful on the day, so I would like to thank the staff that work there. My daughter Jazz and my granddaughter Bo did the deed of cutting my locks off with the help of Bo's grandma, Brenda. The amount raised was a staggering £2,753.37. This money was not just from donations, but also from a charity raffle as well as an auction. Our guest auctioneer was Philip Basham. There was music by my friend Adam Harrod. Last but not least, my close friend Megan Seaman Delahaye must have a special thank you for her immense amount of help. Without her, this event wouldn't have been so successful." That letter was by Jerry Jarvis, sent by email. This is a notice of a memorial service for Anne, Pam, Tennant, adopted daughter of Claughton and Ketchy Pillew Tennant, who grew up at the Pytle near Wedgwood House, Southreps, and died on the 14th of October 2023. There will be a service to commemorate her life at All Saints, Gimmingham, on Friday the 12th of April 2024 at 2 p.m. and afterwards at the Sea Marge Hotel. All welcome. The service will include the blessing of new headstones for Claughton Pellow, woodgraver, artist, and his wife, who painted as Ketchy Tennant 1890 to 1968. Contact Scylla Hannan, email scyllahannam@btinternet.com.
This week's magazine supplement covers a new member for NATO, dog owners needing to be more aware, praise for British B&Bs, and weird weather and resilient vegetables. We begin with Matthew Lee and Lone Cook of the Associated Press reporting on the latest member of NATO. Sweden has formally joined NATO as the 32nd member of the Transatlantic Military Alliance, ending decades of post-Second World War neutrality, as concerns about Russian aggression have spiked after the invasion of Ukraine. Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson and Secretary of State Antony Blinken presided at a ceremony in which Sweden's instrument of accession to the alliance was officially deposited at the State Department. This is a historic moment for Sweden. It's historic for the alliance. It's history for the transatlantic relationship, Mr. Blinken said. Our NATO alliance is now stronger, larger than it's ever been. Mr. Kristersson visited the White House and was a guest of honour at President Joe Biden's State of the Union address to the Congress. The White House said that having Sweden as a NATO ally will make the United States and our allies even safer. NATO is the most powerful defensive alliance in the history of the world, and it is as critical today to ensuring the security of our citizens as it was 75 years ago, when our alliance was founded out of the wreckage of World War II, a spokesperson said. Sweden, along with Finland, which joined NATO last year, both abandoned long-standing military neutrality that was a hallmark of the Nordic states' Cold War foreign policy after Russia invaded Ukraine in early 2022. Sweden's membership had been held up due to objections by NATO members Turkey and Hungary. After months of delay, Turkey ratified Sweden's admission earlier this year, and Hungary did so this week. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg described it as a historic day. Sweden will now take its rightful place at NATO's table, with an equal say in shaping NATO policies and decisions, he said. The Swedish flag will be raised outside the military organisation's headquarters in Brussels on Monday. Mr. Stoltenberg underscored that the Nordic country now enjoys the protection granted under Article 5, the ultimate guarantee of allies' freedom and security. That item was in the EDP of the 9th of March 2024.
And now dog owners are called upon to help stop sheep attacks. Many dog owners might consider it inconceivable that their adorable, affectionate pet would wound or kill another animal. But the increase in savage attacks on farm livestock is evidence that pet dogs can and do pursue their natural instincts when let off the leash in the countryside. New figures from rural insurers NFU Mutual have revealed that the value of livestock severely injured or killed by dogs rose by nearly 30% last year. For example, in recent weeks, one sheep was killed and another injured in Smallborough near North Walsham. It was a traumatic experience both for the flock and for the farmer, who says he knows of other recent cases where as many as 20 sheep have been attacked. Dogs of any breed or size can cause terrible injuries to livestock, particularly at this time of year as the spring lambing season gets underway. But as the rather euphemistic term livestock worrying implies, even the act of barking and chasing farm animals is enough to cause distress, anxiety and miscarriages for pregnant ewes. The devastating impacts of livestock worrying have been recognised by the government, which last month backed a bill to give police greater powers to tackle this crime. They include allowing officers to seize dogs after serious incidents and to take evidence samples from livestock and dogs to assist investigations. These new measures have been welcomed as a positive step by farmers and countryside leaders. But this whole trail of animal trauma, investigations and prosecutions could so easily be avoided if pet owners acknowledged the risks posed by their faithful friends, accepted responsibilities, and kept their dogs on a lead around livestock in the countryside. That article was also from the EDP of the 9th of March 2024.
A lighter note, we hark back some 6 years to R. Lynn writing in praise of the great British B&B. Well, most of them. Today is the first National B&B Day. The bed and breakfast industry is significant, with around 25,000 B&Bs making a contribution of more than £2 billion to the UK economy every year. In my experience, they range from basic. I stayed in one in the Bristol area where my host did not cook the frozen croissants because it was winter, low season, to those that are as good as or better than most hotels. One in Derbyshire was so concerned for our health and well-being that the milk provided with breakfast was just white stuff with no texture or flavour. When it was put into a cup of tea, it made little impact on the dark brown liquid. I'm still not sure what it was. The couple running the establishment was distinctly tetchy with one another. However, our room was delightful. On the Warwickshire canals, we met our most talkative host. While his wife made bacon and eggs, he joined us in the breakfast room and regaled us with his life story. Well, not quite all of it, because we decided to skip toast. The loveliest was undoubtedly in Grasmere, where upon arrival, our host served tea and homemade cherry scones. She baked fresh bread for breakfast, and the tea-making facilities in our room included fresh milk in a flask. No tiny containers of UHT here. It made up for the fact that it didn't stop raining for the entire stay, prompting my first visit to the Keswick Pencil Museum. I have made two subsequent visits to the Lake District, and each time rain propelled me back to the Pencil Museum. Does that make it a propelling pencil museum? Bed and breakfast accommodation has enjoyed a renaissance in recent years. It is now the first resort for many holidaymakers and weekenders, and the industry embraces our penchant for new experiences with all manner of venues and cuisines. With a history stretching back to the 18th century, they have changed the bed linen since then, B&Bs, which have had their hard times in the past, now provide spectacular beds and breakfasts. Meanwhile, there was the B&B in Brighton that issued earplugs to guests. We know not why. That article was from the EDP of the 24th of March, 2018.
This week we stroll down the garden path in the company of Kim Stoddart. Vegetable growers may be lamenting the weird winter, warm and cold, wet and windy, incessant rain, consistently unpredictable. There's no longer seasonality as we were previously used to, says Kim Stoddart, author of The Climate Change Resilient Vegetable Garden, a new book. Editor of Amateur Gardening magazine, Stoddart runs courses on climate change savvy growing from her training gardens in West Wales. She says, weather systems are getting stuck. We've just had a very long period of rain over winter, so there are challenges of extreme weather for plants, for wildlife, and for gardeners. There's a much greater risk of pests and disease with this erratic weather. For example, with warmer, milder, wetter winters, there's more opportunity for pests to overwinter. Here's how to make your plants more resilient. Avoid mollycoddling to help plants toughen up. There's lots of research around this idea that we tend to overwater and overfeed our plants, and because of that they get lazy and don't dig deeper with their roots to seek out the potential gain they can have from the amazing resilience that's below our feet in the soil, she says. If you have no-digs soil that is well mulched and a rich, fertile composition, then the likes of mycorrhizal fungi can help them find food and water. Plants that are watered less and treated in a slightly less pampered capacity become more resilient. Soil management is vital, and saving seeds from the plants that have fared well against extreme weather can also help build resilience. Crops which may withstand our erratic weather include perennials. Perennials, which come back year after year, are an obvious choice, says Stoddart. They're longer lasting in nature, and can develop deeper, wider-ranging root structures, and are arguably more able to cope with extreme weather, including drought, because the roots are far-reaching and can find food and water. They may merge with mycorrhizal fungi and fungal networks to help them find food and water. Amaranth. This is a very popular permaculture plant, and one that I think gardeners are becoming more aware of, but you can grow it easily from seed. It's a really resilient crop, which is great to use in between other plants and as ground cover. You can pick the leaves and eat them like spinach, and you can also harvest the seed and use it like quinoa. It's very pretty as well, so you can plant it in flower beds. The leaves are a russet red. It also self-seeds. I found that using it as ground cover in my polytunnels enabled a lot of my plants to survive because the amaranth helps protect the soil and the plants. Jerusalem artichoke. These perennials produce delicious tubers which are prebiotic in nature and help to feed the healthy gut bacteria in your stomach, she says. They can be used as a windbreak in the vegetable garden, are easy to grow, and you won't harvest all the tubers, so they will grow back. Crystal lemon cucumber is delicious. This is a ball-shaped cucumber, lemon in colour, which is easy to buy. Cucumbers have exacting watering requirements, and I've tried lots of different varieties over the years, but crystal lemon cucumber is so resilient. Start the seeds off indoors, as you would with other varieties of cucumber. It lends itself very well to pickles and preserves, Stoddart says. Plant it with flowering herbs like sage, thyme and lemon balm to help attract pollinators. The Climate Change Resilient Vegetable Garden by Kim Stoddart is published by Cool Springs Press in paperback, price £22. That last item by Kim Stoddart in the EDP of 9th March 2024 concludes this week's magazine supplement. And we thank the editors of the EDP and North Norfolk News and their contributors for permission to use their material.
Our final section of news and views includes Forgotten Stalham, those Haysborough fossils, that fish shop anniversary, and who's that holding up the traffic? And this item is headed Council Authority Accused of Ignoring Town, Forgotten Stalham. It's like downtown New York around here. It sits between the northern reaches of the Norfolk Broads and some of the county's most stunning stretches of coastline. But while Stalham's boatyards send tourists off on their holidays and beachgoers pass through on the way to the seaside, locals say the town is dying on its feet. Resentment boiled over at a recent North Norfolk District Council meeting where the area's councillors claimed the community, once the flourishing centre of Norfolk's weaving industry, had been overlooked. They accused the authority of ignoring the town, instead pumping money into the more glamorous locations of Cromer, Holt and Sheringham. Shut shops, growing antisocial behaviour, drug dealing and a lack of opportunities for youngsters are seen as outcomes of this lack of economic support for Stalham, now considered one of the most deprived areas in the district. While there remains a strong sense of pride in the place, locals are increasingly concerned about the town's future. You'd think it was downtown New York. Many in the community are still reeling after a woman in her 60s was attacked in the high street. A 15-year-old boy has since been arrested, but shockwaves are still reverberating. Stephanie Dove, 30, who recently celebrated the birth of a child, said, "There is a growing antisocial behaviour problem, which I worry puts people off visiting the high street. When I was younger, it had the market. It was a very bustling market town. It is nothing like that now, and there isn't much to keep people here. There are people openly drug dealing in broad daylight. You'd think we were in downtown New York. Holidaymakers visiting will take one walk up the high street and smell weed. What message does that send out? Police have been stepping up patrols in recent weeks as part of efforts to tackle antisocial and drug-related crime. Sergeant Tony Godson said, "We will continue to address problems of antisocial behaviour, including looking at preventative measures and continuing work to identify suspects associated with our investigations." Rosemary Covell London, 70, who has lived in Stalham for 51 years, said, "I think the main thing Stalham is facing is having proper facilities for children to play in. There is not enough done for children and young people." Death of the High Street. Father Stephen Weston, 75, who was instrumental in establishing the Orthodox Christian Church in the town, said, "I do feel Stalham is being overlooked. It used to be a hubbub of activity when the market was on every Tuesday, but Tesco arriving destroyed that. The High Street is on its last legs. People seem to start something, but then it closes as there is not enough footfall. Even charity shops are struggling." Mike Hicks, who has run his antiques shop since the 1970s, said, "The town has been very good to me, but I do worry about the effects of supermarkets and their low prices. They also have free parking, whereas to use the High Street, you have to pay. The High Street recently closed for pavement resurfacing, which added to the pressures on businesses. The cost, £150,000.
That article continues. Consistent neglect. Stalham District Councillors Kevin Bayes and Matthew Taylor recently took NNDC to task for failing to give Stalham a fair share after it was announced it would receive just £20,000 of funding for projects, while Holt, Sheringham and Cromer got vastly more. They worry the town, which sits on the fringes of the district, is being consistently neglected by the council, which they say is in a coastal bubble due to the offices being based in Cromer. Mr. Bayes said, "We keep raising the issue, but nothing changes. The antisocial behaviour comes from a lack of opportunity here. This used to be a key market town in North Norfolk, but it is being undervalued." NNDC has said the reason less money is being spent in Stalham is because it has limited assets there beyond core services, only a small car park and public toilet, whereas in Cromer, Sheringham and Holt, several council-owned assets exist, mostly centred around tourism. Councillor Tim Adams said the North Norfolk district covers an extensive geography with 120 communities, meaning we have to commit resources according to need and opportunity. The authority has said a task force is working with councillors to develop projects for the High Street and that Stalham has been proposed to become a net zero community due to the high levels of fuel poverty. The Forgotten Broads Town. Situated on a branch of the River Ant, Stalham has a rich history and there is evidence of human settlement in the area since the Stone Age. It grew in prominence in the medieval period when it was a thriving farming community and later became the centre of the basket weaving industry. In Victorian times, the High Street was a bustling place with saddle makers, bakers, a stonemason, drapers, milliners, wine shops, pubs, basket makers, an auctioneer, a surgeon, a post office, watchmakers, plumbers, blacksmiths and haberdashers. The town also had two corn mills. In 1880, the railway came to Stalham, bringing cattle, sugar beet, coal and increasingly Broads holidaymakers in and out of the town. At the Broads Museum in the town, this rich history continues to be celebrated, and there is also the Firehouse Museum, located at the site of what is thought to be one of the earliest fire brigades in England. In the late 20th century, much of its previous industry declined. The railway was dismantled in 1959. Its station building was later rebuilt at Holt on the North Norfolk railway line. Stalham's former trackbed to the east of the town now forms part of the Weavers' Way cycle trail. To the west, it is now the A149, which cuts the town centre off from its picturesque stayed area. Despite the town's challenges, tourism remains an important part of its economy. Boat hire firm Richardson's is one of the biggest employers and attracts hundreds of holiday makers each summer. The company has recently announced further investment into its facilities there. And there are photographs of Stalham's colourful high street on a busy day in the summer, with flags, bunting and many coloured gazebos. And a picture of steamboats visiting Stalham's Broad Museum. Again, a multicoloured display of a variety of craft and visitors reflected in the calm waters of the River Ant.
An exhibition featuring fossils from Haysborough Beach is set to be unveiled at the Palace of Westminster. The new exhibition, put together by Norfolk-based conservation charity Explorers Against Extinction, features 10 artworks inspired by Haysborough and hopes to raise awareness about the consequences of climate change through time. It will bring together the work of renowned artists, including Turner Prize-winning artist Richard Deacon and his sculpture Long in the Tooth, which he created using fossils found on the beach at Haysborough. The exhibition will be displayed at the Palace of Westminster from April 15th to 19th, hosted by Broadland MP Jerome Mayhew on behalf of the charity. It will then tour the UK for the next year before going under the hammer to raise funds in support of the charity's wider work to recover key species and restore ecosystems around the world. And a majestic bird held up traffic last Friday afternoon after deciding to swan about in the middle of the road. Jamie Muldowney was driving through the causeway in Potterheim when a swan brought the traffic to a halt. He explained that it stood in the road just before the bridge for several minutes, causing cars to build up behind him. A member of the public eventually escorted it out of danger. Mr. Muldowney said, "It's not the usual traffic jam I'd expect on a Friday afternoon. It was really funny."
And this item is headed Crabulous. Fish shop turns 50. A family-run fresh fish shop in North Norfolk's famous crab capital is celebrating its 50th anniversary. Davis Fish Shop first opened with its doors in Cromer in 1974, with husband and wife Richard and Julie Davis setting up shop in West Street before moving to its current Garden Street home in 1985. Richard, a seventh generation fisherman, would supply the shop with fresh crabs and lobsters caught from his boat JJF, named after his wife Julie, son John, and daughter Fiona. And his catch would then be dressed by Julie before being sold in the town. Richard and Julie retired in 2009, and John and his wife Claire took over the shop. "Where has that 50 years gone?" said John, 58, who followed in his father's footsteps catching the shop's crabs on his boat Gladiator, and now the Richard William. "I remember my parents opening this shop when I was still a schoolboy. It does make you feel proud because there are lots of shops which come and go, and ours has stood the test of time. Here's to the next 50 years." Richard, a former Cromer lifeboat coxswain, died of a brain tumour in 2010, aged 65. "Without Claire, and the same with my father and my mother, Julie, you just couldn't do it," John said. "We're very much a team, and although the fishing and running of the shop are separate, they go well together. No matter where you go in the country, people know about Cromer crabs."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, our listener liaison officer is Imogen Waterson on 01263 587 610. And of course, if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. But please, when returning the pouch and memory stick, remember to reverse the label.
The sound engineer was Richard Preston and the editor-producer Peter Adamson. And our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in thanking you for listening and wishing you a positive and pleasant week. And we look forward to joining you again next Friday. But for now, it's cheerio!